America is obsessed with China, but look back 20 years and America was obsessed with Japan. And the truth is that whatever role America is trying to play in Asia depends on both Japan and China. Everything from North Korea to trade to the status of Taiwan to navigation through the Western Pacific forces America to squeeze between what China wants and what Japan wants. And it's been that way since the 1970s. But Richard McGregor is one of the only authors to look at how all three countries balance each other in Asia's Reckoning, published by Viking. It's a deeply researched, dramatically written book, which builds on his decades of reporting in Asia, most recently for the Financial Times. And it opens a new lens on a region where three global powers bump into each other every day. Welcome to our discussions with one of six authors whose works are shortlisted for the 2018 Lionel Gelber Prize for Best Book in International Relations. The prize is presented annually by the Lionel Gelber Foundation in partnership with Foreign Policy Magazine and the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. These podcasts are sponsored by Focus Asset Management. I'm Rob Steiner, and I'm the director of the Fellowships in Global Journalism at the Monk School. Richard McGregor just joined the Lowy Institute in Australia. But he joins us from Sydney. Richard, welcome.
Hi there.
So I was chatting with a colleague here at the Monk School. Both of us actually spent parts of our careers in Japan. We were talking recently about how difficult it is now to get folks to come in to talk about Japan in a big geopolitical context. There's a feeling that Japan is yesterday's story, that it's a bit player now. The real story is the dance between China and the U.S. Why is that wrong? Like, what do we miss about the U.S.-China relationship when we don't also think about Japan?
Well, I think that's very true because, Japan, of course, people forget, loomed very large at the end of the 80s, the early 90s, when the U.S. and other countries actually considered Japan to be their chief rival, not the U.S. Japan, after that, of course, the Japan boom peaked, the economic bubble burst, and there was a sort of a 20-year sort of slow-motion implosion of the Japanese economy. And I think because of that, because of Japan's sort of rapid rise and fall, the country drifted off the radar screen of many people, and for many people, happily, because it was always a struggle to understand Japan, a different political system, no sort of easily identifiable center of power and the like. But the truth is that Japan, number one, remains an enormously large and powerful country, the third biggest economy even after all of its economic problems. It also is right in the core of East Asia, the fulcrum of East Asia. So if you're thinking about the U.S. and China, you can't think about the U.S. and China without factoring Japan right into the center of it. Now why is that? First of all, the U.S.-Japan security alliance is probably tighter than it's ever been since it was formed in the late 50s, early 60s. Secondly, Japan itself has had a security renaissance under Shinzo Abe, the current prime minister. In other words, its ability to both build up its military and use its military has changed from the sort of the way it used to be constrained by the pacifist constitution and the like. And the third reason, of course, is that China is particularly antagonistic towards Japan for various reasons, because of the U.S. alliance, but going much back further than that, because of the tortured history between Japan and China over the war and the subsequent debates about what had happened in the war and whether Japan properly atoned for it. So Japan actually is at the center of the most important geopolitical rivalry, the U.S. and China. And I guess I've tried to illustrate that in my book.
So I think we should peel these two dimensions of the triangle, if you will, apart and first look for a second at the U.S.-Japan relationship in this context. So how much does the U.S. still need Japan as a core ally in the region? I mean, is Japan just basically an unsinkable aircraft carrier for U.S. military forces that are forward deployed, or is there more to the relationship than that?
Well, certainly that's part of it. Japan is actually America's most important, most significant bilateral military ally. It's not the U.K., it's not some country in the Middle East. The America's most largest naval port offshore is just south of Tokyo. So Japan is a highly significant military ally. It's home to the largest number of U.S. troops stationed offshore. That's the first thing. And I guess the second thing is that it's become more and more important as the China-Japan relationship has frayed. And that really has pushed the U.S. and Japan much closer together. And in other words, they have a common interest, which they didn't have previously, by the way, in pushing back against China. In many respects, it would be quite natural. You know, why can't Asia be run by Asians? Why can't Japan and China get together? But the truth is, and we can talk about this further if you like, they've failed to do that. And that locks the U.S. and Japan together.
This actually is one of the core themes that comes out of your book. And even as someone who lived in Japan, I was struck by the salience of history in the Japan-China relationship. I mean, it's no surprise to anyone who's watched the region that China harbors deep resentment to Japan over its past, the war occupation and so on. But one of the in history, of course, pops up in all sorts of international relations. But I can't think of another set of major power relations that depends so much today on debates about events 70 years ago. So could you give us a sense of how history plays into the daily relationship today between Japan and China? Why is it so stuck?
Yes, it's remarkable, isn't it? You pick up the papers in both countries and you're reading these stories that I feel sort of stuck in aspic from 70 years ago about what happened in the war. I mean, the first thing to say is that, the Japanese atrocities against China in the 30s and 40s is not fake news. It's true the Nanjing massacre happened. The Japanese Imperial Army was guilty of terrible crimes in China. So let's make that clear. But why is this still being discussed? Why hasn't that been resolved? The history wars, or history is one thing, that's true, but the history of the history wars in East Asia is quite another thing, and there's layers of politics and hypocrisy on both sides once you start looking at that. Japan, of course, claims that they've apologized many times, that China is just simply not minded to accept an apology because they see political leverage in keeping the issue alive, and in many respects that's true. You know, people forget that China never made an issue of history in the 50s, 60s, 70s, right through into the mid-80s when it came back with a vengeance. And it came back even more in the 90s when the Chinese Communist Party, after the 1989 military crackdown, needed sort of more leverage with its own population to stir up nationalism behind its rule. And I think that's the way the Japanese have become very, very cynical about Chinese demands for an apology, because they see them as nothing but politics. But having said that, the Japanese continuously shoot themselves in the foot on this issue, to the, I would say, immense fury and frustration of the Americans. Because the Japanese, yes, they have apologized. But every time a Japanese leader apologizes, a few days later, some other significant figure will come along and unapologize, as it were, because there is a sort of deep, sort of dark corner of conservative Japanese politics, which still maintains they did nothing wrong in the war. They just did what other countries did during wars, and they're being victimized. So we haven't been able to get out of this vicious, vicious circle of Japan feeling aggrieved and victimized, and China sort of seeing benefit and advantage, and indeed sort of moral advantage over Japan because of the war. And so it just goes on and on.
So you allude there to how much this frustrates Washington. And you point out in the book that John Kerry, when he was Secretary of State under Obama, actually said that the Japanese Prime Minister, still the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, was America's biggest challenge in Asia, not China, not North Korea, but Shinzo Abe. What did he mean by that?
Yes, this just drives the Japanese crazy, of course, and they think people like Kerry and, to some extent, Obama are sort of unreconstructed left-wingers who are aligned with the Japanese left in criticizing them over the war. But I guess what they Kerry had a point, in as much as the Abe is a historical revisionist, whatever else you think about his prime minister, his leadership. He does believe Japan has been unfairly treated over the war and issues like the comfort women. And for many, many years, Abe couldn't help himself by continuously coming back to this issue and putting it on the table. Now, of course, that that is highly destabilizing in East Asia to pursue this issue. Number one, it destabilizes or undermines a better relationship with South Korea, another core U.S. ally. Number two, it helps China in its propaganda efforts against Japan, a U.S. ally. So the U.S. Under Obama finally focused on this issue and attempted to clean it up, because Abe's talking about the war, they felt, went against U.S. national interests in East Asia and undermined the alliance. And that's what Kerry was talking about.
And today, I mean, Abe was actually, is that actually, in fact, why Abe was the first foreign leader to visit Trump? Did he sort of see that there was a new opening here? Has it changed since Obama left the White House?
Well, I think Abe and Obama always had a difficult relationship, but they managed to work together closely on some issues, to be fair. I think the Abe rushing to Trump Tower a day or two after the election was really about Japanese panic about Trump himself, and the fact that they thought that Trump doesn't really care about traditional U.S. alliances. I mean, the truth is, Japan can't face China alone. Japan needs the U.S. alongside it. And I think that was the real reason for impetus behind Abe's trip.
So there's something about all this. If we sort of switch the focus from the U.S.-Japan relationship and that history to the China-Japan relationship about that history, there's something I've never quite understood, and your book gets into it but still leaves me confused. So it would seem to me that China's calculation in the region would be to say, we're more powerful than Japan. The gap between us and Japan is, we have more leverage over Japan than we do over the United States. We could make common cause with Japan here. There was a period of time when that actually seemed to be happening that you described in the 90s. But it seems like now every time they get close to that, either these debates about World War II or disputes over the Senkaku Island chain, which is this disputed island chain, but very small, it seems to drive them farther apart. From China's perspective, why are these two things worth losing the potential of Japan as an ally against the United States?
I think that is a really fascinating topic, because America's real nightmare in East Asia is if Japan and China got together. If that happened, then there'd be really no need much for the U.S. in East Asia at all. So if you're a Chinese strategist, why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you encourage better relationships with China? Why wouldn't you, out of pure practical reasons, try and put history behind you? And there are a number of Chinese scholars and commentators who've said exactly that. But they were slapped down quite brutally. Now, the question is, why? Why does that happen? And I think it's about the internal political dynamics inside the Chinese Communist Party. The truth is that if you want to whip up nationalist patriotic sentiment in China to your benefit, there's absolutely no better issue to do it inside the Chinese Communist Party than giving Japan a good kick. And that makes it extremely dangerous for any leader, no matter how powerful, to reach out to Japan and build a sustained good relationship. In other words, build trust inside Japan, make gestures which will build trust inside Japan, that will pull Japan away from the U.S. And I think the reason it hasn't happened is just because the issue of Japan inside internal Chinese politics is just toxic. And I've tried to illustrate that in a number of places by looking at internal Chinese writings and the way that people who are considered pro-Japan come under really vicious attack. And that really makes it difficult for any Chinese leader, no matter how powerful, to really shift China on this issue.
But there was a period of time that you also write about in the 90s when China was warming to Japan, and when even the LDP, at one point, LDP, the ruling party of Japan at the time, turned to, I think, someone in the State Department and said, "We have really good back-channel relations with the Communist Party, so don't worry about getting us together, we're fine."
Yes, well, that's right. The other side of the coin is that within Japan, there's always been a large pro-China element, or a large element which is favorable to China, a large element in Japan which sees Japan's future in Asia, which sees, a region being run by Asians, not by outsiders who are the Americans. Now, they still are outsiders. But I think in Japan, we've seen actually, in some respects, a mirror image of what happened in China. I think the Chinese assertiveness towards Japan, Chinese refusal to sort of build up trust with Japan, meant that the pro-Japan, pro-China people inside Japan also had the rug pulled from under them. And so while there were very good relations for a long time, when the conservatives in Japan, who didn't support building bridges with China, came along, they had lots of ammunition to use against the sort of pro-China caucus inside Japan, inside the LDP, inside the foreign ministry. And so in that way that's happened in many other conflicts, I think, the hardline elements in both Japan and China brought out the worst in both systems and ensured that the countries did remain far apart rather than coming together in some sort of new Asian consensus.
So you're sitting now in a very interesting spot. You're sitting in Sydney. You're going to work for Australia's most prominent, one of the world's most prominent international relations think tanks. Australia in this kind of environment is not completely unlike Canada in that, you know, we have growing and deep relations with China and with the United States. So if you're advising the Australian government, as you probably will end up doing before long, or the Canadian government, how do these other Western allies try to navigate this narrow space between Japan, China, and the United States?
Australia is, in fact, a much more sensitive position than Canada. Australia actually has had built really deep ties with Asia, mainly economically, but also politically, first with Japan and later with China. But that's coming under, you know, incredible stress right now in Australia. Because, you know, Australians or leaders always used to say, oh, we don't have to choose between our sort of economic destiny and our security destiny. In other words, we don't have to choose between, you know, China and America. Well, that, of course, is proving to be a fallacy. We're faced with choices every day. Australia has enjoyed enormous benefits from its economic relationship with China, but now we're getting the rise of political China, geopolitical China. And it's been very, very uncomfortable. And Australia has been pushing back against what it regards as illegitimate interference by China in the internal Australian political system. And I think that is a symptom generally of an effort to push back against Chinese influence regionally. It's one and the same thing. And China has reacted very badly to that. So Chinese-Australian relations are actually at a sort of a two-decade or decade-long low point right now with the threat that they'll get worse. You know, Australia in many respects is the canary in the coal mine of Western democracies in trying to grapple with Chinese political influence. And I don't quite know where that debate comes out yet.
So if in this transition from working with economic China to somehow dealing with political China, what lessons should the rest of the Western world be learning from Australia right now?
Well, I hope the lesson will be that you should stand firmly up for your own national interests. I think what China wants is that Western countries, or all countries, but Western countries being potentially much more important than larger partners, internalize the sort of global political map of the Chinese Communist Party. And that means you internalize Chinese concerns about Taiwan, you internalize Chinese concerns about Tibet and the like. All the issues that are important for the Communist Party should be reflected within your own polity. And then, of course, you should stay out of the things that they want to run themselves in Asia, the most important being the South China Sea, where there are multiple overlapping, conflicting claims between numerous Asian countries, and China wants you to stay out of that. That's a territorial issue of sovereignty. So I think China wants to put pressure on Western countries to adopt the matrix that operates within its own political system. Now, Australia and Canada, I think, is particularly sensitive because we both have very large and of recent times mainland Chinese-dominated Chinese communities who are being accused of having dual loyalties or being pulled in two different directions. So that's an enormously difficult issue to manage, particularly in a country like Australia, and I won't speak to Canada, you know, which has had racist immigration policies in the past, where race is a sensitive issue. And to have people starting to talk about the Chinese community as some kind of fifth column is a really tough conversation to have.
And brings all of these large geopolitical issues into a very intimate space where the basic values of our countries are at stake.
That's right. But also for the Chinese, it's, you know, the Chineseness of the issue, it's a highly emotional issue. Yeah. And China takes great exception. I mean, China, the Communist Party, is actually quite open about seeing the overseas Chinese community as a possible extension of its reach. They hold meetings about this issue quite openly in Beijing with representatives of the overseas Chinese community. They talk about the blood link with the motherland. How a foreign country is meant to react to that.
And something that the Chinese communities in Canada, and I would imagine Australia, also have resisted and split deeply over.
That's right. And the great splits within the communities, even though from the outside they often feel tarred with the same brush. How do you talk about that issue? It's not being Chinese. It's about the Communist Party. How do you stop it be lapsing into a sort of a racially sort of tinged argument? And that's an issue Australia's trying to grapple with now. And I think, I'm sure, actually, that the Canadians, amongst others, are looking very closely at how Australia handles this, and just as importantly, how China responds.
Richard McGregor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Richard McGregor is the author of Asia's Reckoning, published by Viking. If you'd like to hear more Lionel Gelber podcasts, you can find all of this year's discussions and many from previous years on iTunes by searching for Lionel Gelber Prize. That's G-E-L-B-E-R Prize. Or at our website, monkschool.utoronto.ca. Monk is spelled M-U-N-K /Gelber. Thanks to the Lionel Gelber Foundation in Foreign Policy Magazine. And a special thanks to Focus Asset Management, funding media partner of these podcasts. I'm Rob Steiner, director of the Monk School's Fellowship in Global Journalism, and I'm glad you joined us.